Hello and welcome to the Just Interesting podcast, the podcast where nothing is fascinating, everything is better than boring, because it's just interesting. That almost worked. With me, Robin, today are Martin. Hello, Martin.
Hello, Robin.
How are you?
How are you doing? You look like you're in the jungle.
I am in the jungle.
Because if anyone, listening to this instead of watching, Robin's got a what I imagine is a bit of a sound booth up there, but it has a jungle vibe to it in the background.
It does. It's really nice. A little bit of green fabric and leafy kind of design on it. Yeah,
wonderful.
Some
wonderful.
Absorbent panels on the wall and some absorbent panels on the floor. Yeah, freestanding. And Alex, how are you?
I'm good as well. Thanks, Robin. Yeah, no, I'm very jealous of your backdrop.
Thank you.
As you can see, for those of you seeing rather than listening, I have nothing behind me. Absolutely nothing. I've got nothing.
A void.
You're in a Verdansk cell.
Just infinite beige all around.
Although,
me.
You do have some nice gaming lights that you use on our Twitch streams, which is very, very good. Kind of.
They're not nice. I've got one tiny pathetic light that doesn't even light up the room. It's terrible. But no, there's no follow up to that.
It's just
maybe one day I can improve it. But I'm still waiting for suggestions what I can put behind me, because I need to do some decorating in here. I think
life size cardboard cutouts of me and Robin.
That'd be nice.
Yeah,
that'd be nice.
We'll send you photos. Yeah. Put your suggestions in the comments below if you're watching us on YouTube or on the podcast platform of your choice. Please give us feedback. If you can't leave a review, whether it's because it's not iTunes or whatever it is, Apple Podcasts, sorry. Please check out our Twitter and give us your thoughts on Twitter, JInterestingYT. Thank you very much.
Exactly.
Today, we'll be discussing something inspired by recent events and hopefully to put a positive spin on recent events, which is to do with people who are worshipped as gods.
Oh. Robot Robin, number one. Oh, he's not a person.
Oh, no, I'm not. Oi, wait, what? Robots are people too, and I'm not a robot. Let's just clear the air now. But yeah, that'll be the topic of discussion. But of course, before all that, we'll be revealing the things that we learned this week. And afterwards, we'll be having a quiz, which I wrote for Alex and Martin to go head-to-head, because the league table is getting tight, man. It's getting tight, man.
It's very close.
yeah, I mean, we're nearing the end of the season three now, so it'll soon be time to announce the winner of the trophy.
I think from the quiz today, it will either be I take the lead or Martin makes it level, so we're all drawing.
Yeah, so if Martin makes it level, neck and neck.
Wow.
Competition.
Wow. Deep breaths.
Martin's currently the trophy holder, so Martin.
I'm coming.
So Martin's interested
Martin.
To tie again, so he can keep the trophy.
Thoughts and prayers.
So, gentlemen, without any further ado, what did you learn this week, Alex?
Well, I learned something very interesting this week. Have either of you heard of The Man Who Never Was?
Sounds like a terrible, terrible, terrible 80s film.
You're wrong, Martin. It was a 50s film. A 1956 Cannes Film Festival film.
Oh, it was a film.
Yeah, it was. The Man Who Never Was. You are absolutely right. But it's based on a real story.
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
On Operation Mincemeat. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
Sorry, I'm almost just spat out my coffee. No, Operation Mincemeat. What a name.
Okay, let me give you the rundown. So the year is 1943. It's the height of the war. Germany is on the offensive in the Soviet Union, and at this point the tides are starting to turn in favor of the Allies, starting to anyway. And in Spain, on a beach one day, a Spanish fisherman finds a body of a British Royal Marine soldier.
Mm.
And the ID on this man reads Major William Martin. There's just one problem, though. This major never existed. He never existed. And in finding this body, the fisherman actually set into motion a long planned out ruse by the British Secret Service to fool Adolf Hitler into making a glaring tactical blunder.
The man who never
Roll the credits. So basically, This was a plan devised in a document that was actually thought to be written up by none other than Ian Fleming.
Yeah.
No way, creator of James Bond and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
So at this point in the war, the Allies had just had huge success in the North African campaign. And they were looking at where they could invade next from here. And they basically had two options. They had two obvious options. They had Sicily, which would be a big tactical advantage, give the Allies a tactical advantage in Italy, and push through to push through to Europe that way. Or Greece was another option that they could go for, and then they would be able to move north and funnel the Nazis into a kind of pincer motion into the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. So there were two different options, but the option the Allies decided to go for was Sicily. However, Sicily was a very obvious target. It was very obvious that the Nazis would notice that they were going to attack. The Allies would attack Sicily. It was right in front of them. It was obvious that it was going to be Sicily. So what did they do? They devised a plan to get a corpse of someone, and they found a Welsh homeless vagrant who had just killed himself in King's Cross, St. Pancras, and they dressed him up to make him look like a Major William Martin, who just so happened to be holding some important documents, some important top secret classified documents. And they chose Spain to drop off this body because Spain was known at the time to be rife with Nazi spies and intelligence. And it was very clever because what they did is they actually hid an eyelash in one of the documents. And so the official policy with Spain is that anytime they found British secret documents, they would return them to London straight away.
Right.
And that's what the Spanish did. But they were able to tell that they had let people look through the documents first because they noticed that this eyelash, which was placed very specifically in amongst the pages, was no longer there. So they had known that someone had looked through these documents and seen them.
I'm not going to lie, mate. An eyelash can move quite easily, can't it?
I was thinking that. They must have submerged
in water.
Yeah, yeah.
They must have vacuum sealed these documents.
It's an old trick. You see it in a lot of spy movies where they pluck a hair from their head and they'll put it against the door frame across the crack in the door so that they know if somebody's been in the room because they'll have opened the door. But yeah, I feel like papers being removed from a dead body and being put in transit from Spain to Britain, chance of the eyelash moving seem a bit high. But it's a good idea, and it clearly worked.
Well, I mean, it did. It did work. Because of this, because of Operation Mincemeat, Adolf Hitler was convinced that he'd got one over on the Allies.
those Nazis. Führer, we are the Nazis. What?
He was convinced that he'd got an insight into their plans, and was convinced that they were going to attack Greece instead. Sorry, I should have said that's what they put in the documents.
Their plans were
to attack Greece rather than Sicily. So he moved an entire panzer unit of 90,000 troops away from Italy to Greece, where the Allies had no intention of going.
I mean, fair play to this Welsh homeless guy who died in St. Pancras.
And the Welsh homeless guy who killed himself thinking that his life was absolutely worthless.
He was more useful in death than life, to be fair.
Mm.
Well, in death, he was able to fool the Nazis. And ultimately, you know, this could have been a huge turning point on the war. And because of this, Hitler was actually planning a huge offensive against the Soviet Union a week after the Allies invaded Sicily. But because the invasion was successful, he cancelled that huge operation and recalled a fifth of the entire German army from the Eastern Front to protect the Mediterranean, thus giving the Soviet Union a bigger advantage in pushing further west. This could have been a huge turning point in the war. And it was all because of one Welsh homeless man by the name of Glyndwr Michael.
Glyndwr Michael.
Was his name.
Poor bloke, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, imagine trying to get that clearance now. What do you want to do? Oh, yeah, we just want to actually get a dead body of someone who's died in London and just put it on a boat, take it out to sea, drop it to it, just, you know. I'm not sure it would happen nowadays, would it?
I know, military intelligence. I think they would, especially in a World War situation. They totally would. But yeah, that's great, though. That's a great story. And it goes to show just how important intelligence and intelligence networks and spies and spycraft is in winning wars. And particularly because in the biggest disadvantage, I guess, the Nazis had in World War II is that the Führer, Hitler himself, made all the military strategy. He made the final decisions. Everything had to go through him. And once he really got off his rocker towards the end of the war, he was not making rational decisions.
No.
Well, yeah, Mussolini during this was saying to Hitler, I really think you're being tricked, mate. I really, really think they're going to attack Sicily. They're definitely going to attack Sicily. Oh, yep, they're attacking Sicily right now. he warned Hitler, and Hitler didn't listen to him. Thankfully, he didn't.
Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, I think it's quite a well-known story now, but it's I found out about it for the first time this week, and I thought it was very interesting.
That's a great story, yeah. Martin, what did you learn this week?
Well, I need to ask you guys a question. How much do you value wildlife, and in particular birds?
I hate them.
No. Hate them with a passion.
No, I'm pretty pro the environment, pretty pro birds.
Yeah.
You're pro birds. Probably,
is my official stance.
Well, that's good. And so is this village in India, which did its absolute utmost to save a nest of baby birds. And so in this little village in Tamil Nadu, in the Sivanga district of India, apologies for my pronunciation there, it's definitely wrong, they found a little nest of birds that was, well, nesting on the main switchboard of the town, which controls their streetlights. So at 6 o'clock each evening, this man, it was his job to go out and turn on the lights on the switchboard and light up the town in the evening so everyone could walk around safely. And this one evening, he got to the switchboard and he found these baby birds nesting there with their mother. And so he went back to the villagers, and about 250 people, I think, in this village, 120 houses, maybe slightly more, and said, "No, guys, I can't turn on these lights. I can't disturb this nest because these baby birds and the family are living there." And so they got round, had a village meeting, and they decided that they weren't going to turn on those lights and use the switchboard until the baby birds had hatched and flown away.
Aww.
And so they waited for 45 days, 45 days, without any lights in the village as a result. And so their kindness saved these birds' life, and I think is maybe a little bit of a lesson to us all to care for nature and forego your streetlights if it's going to save some baby birds.
That is great.
Oh, that's
a heartwarming story.
Yeah.
It is a little bit, isn't it? It's not as exciting as yours, Alex, but I thought it was a nice light one to go with all
that was lovely.
The misery that we usually
I think it's a nice transition from World War II death and destruction heroics to to saving humanity, saving birds. That's nice.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly.
So I guess they couldn't. There was no other way. They couldn't move the nest, could they?
No, they did. Well, he didn't want to disturb the nest because otherwise the mother would have flown off and apparently left the birds and they would have just died. Mm. And this Indian robin, apparently there aren't too many of them left. Their numbers have been declining, like pretty much every species around the world. So they decided to forego their streetlights. So very, very nice of them.
That's wonderful. And yeah, they got them in the end, right? They just waited.
They just waited 45 days.
Just a little bit of patience to give those birds a chance. Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah. I mean, probably they found that a week later, another one had found the original nest and occupied it again.
Yeah.
But
they tried to help.
It didn't say that they took any precautions to prevent this happening again in the future. So I mean, I guess it could happen again.
Those birds would have left the nest and learned that the streetlights were a fantastic place to build nests. So
exactly. I imagine so.
Well,
how about you, Robin?
What did I learn this week? It feels like I can't follow up those two stories. Those are two really nice stories, really good stories. And mine's not a story. It's just a fact that was in the news this week to do with physics, which is that according to physics, the standard model of how our universe works acknowledges four fundamental forces that govern everything. They are gravity, electromagnetism, and something called the strong force and something called the weak force, which is great. Science, love it. But there have been new experiments, the results of which have been recently announced, which on particles, you know, things like the Large Hadron Collider and some other laboratories like that, doing particle physics experimentations, on particles called muons. And their observations suggest that they may be on the cusp of discovering a fifth fundamental force that governs the universe. And this fifth fundamental force might explain something that some scientists argue for, which is dark energy, the sense that particularly to explain the universe is expanding, and actually as it expands, it seems to be speeding up at the rate at which it expands. And some scientists have suggested for a while now that it's this dark energy, this kind of invisible energy that comes from nowhere and just seems to exist. A lot of other physicists are skeptical of that, but they think that maybe this potential fifth force might actually be what is currently being called dark energy, but isn't. So yeah, that's...
Wow.
That's what I learned this week, yeah.
Physicists, they're just on another level at the moment, aren't they? I mean, like, what?
They're really making leaps and bounds, aren't they?
Yeah. They're like, oh, we might have discovered another determining energy thing, determining, like, the universe makeup. What?
We found the God
particle. I'm over here making a podcast. How can you found that out? That's not fair. How do you just find that out?
There's always a question, funding, isn't it?
There's always this how. Like, what research do you conduct to find that? I mean, there's plenty of answers, I'm sure, but it just seems like how do you start and get into that field in the first place? Yeah, amazing, wonderful.
Yeah, that's at this point that really Homer exciting. Simpson just goes nerd.
I can't get over though. Having said all that, like. There's something very... They've got these really complicated names for the first two, and then what was it? The strong energy and the weak energy.
And then this is the strong energy.
This is the weak energy. Yeah, you can tell that gravity and electromagnetism were discovered and identified a long time ago, because all of modern science is just strong force, yeah, weak force, yeah, we'll do that. Yeah. Sudden death syndrome, yeah. So, before we get into the main topic of this week's podcast... Shall we do comments of the week?
So I've got a comment from Willa Wolf, and this is about biscuits. Remember last week on the podcast, we were discussing biscuits. Mm-hmm. First of all, there's a couple of things we wanted to know. Basically, what an American biscuit was, because we were talking about our biscuits versus American biscuits.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And also, we asked the question last week, why are digestive biscuits called digestive biscuits?
Yes.
And Willa Wolf says, the whole biscuit thing. Our biscuit is like a flaky bread roll, which is not how I imagined it, actually. Flaky bread roll.
I thought it was going to be more like a scone kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah. So that's insightful. Thank you. And then he said, and I recently learned that, yes, your digestive biscuit was indeed created to help with the digestion, or to put it another way, to help you go. So there you go.
There you go. Thank you.
They could have come up with a nicer name for it. I kind of wish I actually didn't know that now. But.
Are they particularly fibrous? I'm not even sure.
I don't know. Maybe they are.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. Get back
Although,
to us,
at the time they were invented.
About the fiber content.
That was the golden age of home remedies, isn't it? Like, this thing will grow your hair back. This thing will help you go. So, now. Nah.
Exactly.
That's true.
Yeah.
It's just some. This probably has hardly any fiber in it at all. Like, here, have this. Yeah. But yeah, no, thank you for that. I can never learn enough about biscuits.
Good.
What's funny about that?
I can never learn enough about biscuits.
I agree. I just love that. Leave that in isolation. Just let that comment stand on its own. Oh.
That's good.
Well, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that, Alex, because that's a fairly positive outlook on life. And on last week's podcast, I think one of the questions Martin asked in the quiz was, what's the world's rarest kind of blood type? Was that it? And Morgus commented, I think Martin said, what type of blood type are you? And both of us said, oh, we don't know. But Mordith commented saying, judging by Alex's past dispositions, what's the betting his blood type is B negative?
Brutal.
But then Mordith says, outside chance it's B positive, though.
True. That's, I mean, it's, yeah, I mean, it's accurate. It's
you're not negative. You're not really negative.
I'm trying to be a B positive. Trying my hardest to be a B positive.
Yeah. That New Year's resolution, you keep me up to it. It's good. It's good.
Yeah. It's easier to be more positive this year, I think. Now I'm living in Edinburgh. It feels, I don't know, lots more outside time. That sounds like I'm in prison.
Yard time, yeah.
Lots more yard time here. Just generally nicer area. So, yeah. Good, and plus, things to look forward to. Vaccine rollout, sure, yeah.
Nice. Very true.
Positive outlook.
Good.
Good. Well, I've actually got a review for us this week.
Oh, cool.
This one's from Nuclear Pasta, who left a review on Apple Podcasts/iTunes. So if you guys want to,
is it Nuclear Pasta with cheese?
You can. It's not Nuclear Pasta with cheese, but it's Nuclear Pasta with two A's. Pasta. Yeah. So this is titled A Wee Poem for You Guys, and it goes like this. There once was a radio station where Martin couldn't hide his frustration, and Alex would strop because they just couldn't stop Robin mentioning castration.
That's incredible.
And that's from Michael in Bonnie Dundee. And he also says, love the show, guys. Keep it up. So thank you, Michael.
Thank you,
and
Michael.
Thanks for your effort there.
Incredible.
Yeah, incredible. Really
good. Oh, I want to frame it.
Yeah, you know, actually, that's worthy. That's incredible. That's worthy of it. Oh,
well, how many subscribers would we have to get for you to get that tattooed onto yourself somewhere?
Now, I'm not going to say this because it's bound to backfire.
Yeah, you came dangerously close to dyeing your hair blue, didn't you, after that?
I did. And I'm not going to dye my hair blue anymore, but if people do want to follow us on Twitch, you can see our live performances of the Just Interesting podcast when we next do it, which may even be next week, potentially. We might do it again next week.
Did we say, okay.
We haven't discussed it, but
I did not know that was a thing, but yeah, sure, why not? Yeah.
Why not? Then head on over to twitch.tv/just_interesting. Mm-hmm. Cool.
And follow Twitch anyway, because Martin and Alex are currently playing through A Way Out together. It's co-op heaven.
We are getting yard time.
Yeah.
We are getting yard time indeed. We're escaping getting a lot prison. Of yard time at the moment.
Yeah. Best double team you'll ever see on Twitch. That's what I said. And that's what I'm sticking to.
I'm sticking to it.
So, with that all said and done, let's move on to the main topic of today's podcast, which is people who were worshipped as gods. Now, I think each of us has gone and found a person who was worshipped as a god by somebody. And they're all pretty interesting stories, I think. But it was suggested by Martin, who was inspired by current affairs because... Well, Martin, I'll let you take over and introduce.
Well, as we've been told a billion times this week about the sad passing of Prince Philip, and
Prince Philip died.
Well, apparently so.
Yeah, your Duke, Alex, your local Duke has died.
Exactly.
No one told me.
Yeah.
It's been on the news.
Not really. Few and far between. But yes, unfortunately, Prince Philip did die at the age of 99, so he didn't get the letter handed to him from his wife, unfortunately. But what this did bring up was a story about two villages in Vanuatu. And in particular, this particular island called Tanna, where they thought that the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Philip, was a godlike spiritual figure. And so there's this connection between Prince Philip and this island of Tanna, because the people of Tanna believe that the Duke... was originally from Tanna. He transformed into Prince Philip so he could get close to the Queen, who of course is, well, at the time that they started believing in this, way back in the 50s, I think it was, The Queen, of course, one of the most powerful people in the world. And so to give their island more prominence on the global stage, they believe, or did believe, and some still do, that Prince Philip was actually originally from Tanna and is a spiritual godlike figure who's basically made his way to the top of the world.
I mean, yeah.
Which I think is just amazing.
So do they think he's reincarnated, or do they think he can literally transformed into Prince Philip?
So from what I believe, they think that a tribesman left the island,
right,
in his original spiritual form to find a powerful wife overseas. That's how it's said by an expert called Mr. Huffman, who's an expert in the history of this. And so it goes on to say that ruling the UK with the help of the Queen, he was trying to bring peace and respect for tradition to England and other parts of the world. And so the idea that he would do this, and then later on he would return to this village of Tanna as a hero. But there's kind of another element to it, and that they believe that the only thing preventing him from coming back to the island of Tanna was white people's stupidity, jealousy, greed, and perpetual fighting.
I mean,
and so they basically believe that Prince Philip had this mission to plant the seed of Tanna at the heart of the Commonwealth and the Empire. So everything that Tanna stands for, so these things of tradition,
yeah,
and of their culture and their way of life.
Yeah,
and so they see him as basically a godlike hero, who's basically elevating their ways around the world.
This must have been a devastating week for them.
Exactly, but the other side of it is there's this whole thing of Prince Philip returning home to Tanna, and they never say whether he returns as in human form or whether he returns in a spiritual kind of form. So it's unclear whether they're going to move on to another member of the royal family as this deity, or whether they'll put it to rest now that Prince Philip has passed. It must be said that when this particular movement originated way back in the 1950s and potentially before then, they're not entirely sure of the exact year, that there are thousands of people that believe this in these small villages, and now it's several hundred. So again, the kind of the people that have this as a central core belief has definitely diminished over the years, it must be said.
Right.
But Prince Philip has actually bought into this. He's appeared publicly and accepted their reverence. He sent letters to them and photographs of himself. I think that it's probably more for tribal Commonwealth relations as opposed to anything else.
Yeah, keep them on side, yeah.
Exactly. But it's interesting. I mean, a little bit later on in 2007, some of the tribesmen were flown to the UK for a Channel 4 documentary. So they actually did end up meeting him. Huh. He never actually went back to the island. They asked him if he would head back with them.
He didn't.
Of course, he couldn't at the time. And of course, he didn't. But Prince Charles, I believe, has since.
Oh.
They don't see Prince Charles as a god yet, like they did with Prince Philip. But yeah, they viewed him for a number of years, and some still do, as a spiritual deity. Yeah. In this particular remote community, which is just absolutely bizarre. So yeah, unfortunately for them, they're in a period of mourning at the moment and having lots of ceremonies, marking his death and I guess celebrating his life. But times are changing. In the village of Tanna.
Yeah, I mean, so the theory was that he went out to plant the seed of Tanna.
Yes, of their traditions. And the only reason he hasn't returned is because of, the terrible things that the white people have done.
Yeah. I mean, the way they describe us is pretty accurate. Can't knock them there.
Yeah.
Do we know much about their values and things? Because I was pleasantly surprised to learn this week that actually Prince Philip was writing back in the 1980s about climate change and the science of climate change and how it was overwhelmingly obvious that we had adversely affected the climate and would have to do something about it. And that was back in the 80s. I mean, obviously, it was the first science about it occurred, I think, the late 60s and throughout the 70s. But you got the royal consort, second most important person in our country, probably, the British Empire still writing about it and talking about it. So that's pretty progressive for the time, for the 1980s in particular.
Yeah, so absolutely.
That maybe that's some truth to that. You know?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think the from my point of view, it seems like as I say, they're trying to elevate the customs of their land. It says that they were trying to bring peace and respect for tradition. Well, they're living in a community that rejects a lot of modern technology. They don't have any kind of any mobile phones or any links to the outside world and society. So I think there's this idea that they're trying to kind of remain true to themselves and true to their traditional ways of life, and almost trying to spread this around the world. I mean, there's been a few interpretations, and one is that it could be a kind of reaction to colonialism.
Yes.
And kind of taking back a little bit that control that was, and power that was lost due to basically, I guess, the royal family and the empire taking over so much of the world from communities like this.
Mm.
And so it almost seems like, okay, well, if we believe that actually one of ours is at the top of global power, then it kind of almost gives us a little bit of that power back that was taken from us in the past. So there's that side of it too.
That's a good way of looking at it, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting one anyway, an interesting one.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Gosh, what well, that, Martin. Yeah.
I don't want to detract from Prince Philip's godly status, but the story I chose actually also takes place on the island of Tanna in Vanuatu.
No, really?
on the eastern side of the island, they have a very, very different religious practices. And they don't worship Prince Philip, but this was the start of a cargo cult focusing on a man named John Frum. And this is actually a little bit of a cop-out, to be honest, because we don't know if John Frum was a real man. Like, we don't have an official record of his existence. Yeah. We don't know if that's his real name. But it's thought that John Frum was an American GI during World War II that visited the island of Tanna. And this religion came to pass. It rose in the late 1930s. However, there are also claims that it started in 1949 or the 1910s, but I'm not really sure.
Yeah,
I'm not really sure. I think there's just not not very obvious records of when this cropped up. Well, it's kind of like hearsay, to be honest.
I mean, these communities are so remote, aren't they?
Yeah.
So there isn't exactly the record taking that we find elsewhere.
Mm. But this is. This movement sprung up apparently because it was influenced by religious practices in the local area from Sulphur Bay, which is on the east side of Tanna. And they worshipped a god called Kira Paraman, which is a god associated with a mountain there on the island. And in some versions of a local story, a native man named Manahivi, using the alias John Frum, began appearing among the native people of Tanna dressed in a Western-style coat, assuring the people that he would bring them houses, clothes, food, and transport. And then there's another theory that John Frum is actually an induced spirit vision from taking a local plant called kava, which I guess is a hallucinogenic sort of plant, maybe like similar to what's that plant called?
Ayahuasca.
Ayahuasca, yeah.
Ayahuasca. Martin's choice.
But yeah, no, a common thought with this is that John Frum was an American GI who visited the island during the war and brought lots of cargo with him, shared this out with the locals. Perhaps he was particularly kind and got to know them and shared some of their resources, some Coca-Cola or some other luxuries from the modern world. And then when he left, they began this religion dedicated to John Frum. What is it about this island that they seem to just just worship people that come there.
That is an interesting one.
I guess
that you said the same one. Yeah.
Think about it like from their point of view, I guess, if they are just untouched by outside civilizations and then in comes someone with all the luxuries of the modern world, riding on a mechanized boat, with technology that they'd never seen before.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, you might think that they're a god, to be honest. It's not the least logical thing in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, true. I mean, the island's made up of villages, isn't it? And has roughly 30,000 people, I've seen. So it's not the tiniest of tinies, but I mean, you can compare that to the whole world.
Like the small community, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, there's this recurring pattern with this guy coming and going away, similar to the Prince Philip thing. It's like he's gone away and they think he'll come back. Is that kind of the root of this John Frum thing? He did go away and come back repeatedly, but then one day he never comes back. So there's this kind of like, oh, he will come back one day. They're kind of like it's the same thing with like any kind of messiah in the Judeo-Christian religions, the sense of they will return and save us.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting point. I mean, I feel like there could be some really good research on this like topic of why this island in particular seems to, I don't know, choose gods that visit and leave the island. It's really interesting. But in 1957, there was a whole John Frum movement, and the leader of the John Frum movement created the Tanner Army, which was, unlike its name, a non-violent ritualistic society that organized military-style parades of men with faces painted in ritual colors and wearing white t-shirts with the letters T-A-U-S-A, Tanner Army USA. And this parade takes place every year on February 15th.
Oh, wow.
The date on which followers believe John Frum will return, and which is observed as John Frum Day in Vanuatu.
Wow.
This is amazing. That's crazy. This is amazing. I love it. Oh, it's too late for us to become gods of any small tribe, isn't it? The world's been explored.
Too much pressure. Too much pressure.
Too much pressure.
Couldn't handle that.
Head then, there's a big metallic statue to you, Robin.
Yeah.
A robotic-looking statue in the middle of the island.
No.
I think this... this yearly celebration still goes on today, but I'm not actually sure how many of them still do it sincerely or it's just become a kind of local tradition.
Two old guys. It's become like Krampus. It's like Krampus. Everyone does Krampus. It for fun.
Yeah. I mean, you get... What's that? There's that island in Italy, isn't there? Is it in Italy? Where there's like a native tribe that's untouched by civilization
in Italy,
and there was someone that went that maybe I'm not thinking of Italy, maybe I'm thinking somewhere else, but wasn't there someone who went to the island a few years ago and got killed with a bow and arrow?
I thought that was in the Amazon.
Do you remember that story?
I thought that was in the Amazon. Maybe I'm wrong.
That probably would make more sense than Italy. I don't know why I thought of Italy.
Well known for
what am I thinking of Italy for?
I mean, it could be Italy. I just
native tribes.
I just feel like it's unlikely that at this point in history that there'd be a native tribe untouched in Italy. This seems odd.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking of something totally different. But yeah, I just think whenever like you see like helicopters going over and the tribes people like looking up at the helicopter where the footage is being taken from, you just think, what are they thinking? What are they thinking when they see this? Mm-hmm. Crazy machine.
And it's an old trope of literature going back a long time to at least, if not before, you know, the arrival of Cortez and the other Spaniards in South America, and you know, they claimed that the Aztecs saw them as gods. Not true, they didn't, but that was what they claimed. And it's kind of similar to the example I've got today, which, funny, we seem to be working backwards in time, gone from Duke of Edinburgh, who's just died, to John Frum, who was in the 1940s or perhaps earlier, to... We do know the beginning of this thing, which is in the 1840s in India, or what is now actually Pakistan, half a dozen Muslim Indians started a religious cult. And they devoted their lives to worshipping a being called Nikal Sain. And the last member of the Nikal Sainis died in 2004 in Abbottabad, Pakistan.
Wow.
So starting in the 1840s, continued until 2004 when the last member of this cult died. But Nikal Sain...
That must be sad, being the last member of a cult.
But we know...
Knowing that it's going to die.
We know that Nikal Sain was actually a fellow called John Nicholson. Brigadier General John Nicholson, who was the district commissioner of this part of the Northern Territories in India when it was part of the British Empire, and when the British Empire was trying to take over Afghanistan at the same time. And he was quite remarkable for his time. He was a hero to the British because he was instrumental in their expansion. And he worked for the British East India Company, and he was instrumental in conquering northern parts of India and in establishing British authority there and in propagating it, because he impressed everybody with his foul temper and his 6'2" height and big beard, which in the 1840s the average height was about 5'6", so he was pretty big.
Yeah, that's cool.
Pretty big for the time. And he was enthusiastic and unrelenting in his enforcement of British rule. He became district commissioner over the North Punjabi and Afghan tribes of the Banu region, and he was known for flogging pretty much anybody for any reason whatsoever. In fact, the Sir John Lawrence, who was a friend of his, criticized him quite vocally for flogging people even when he didn't have the authority to do it. He would just flog them. And he also criticized him for his fondness for humiliating Indian leaders. For example, the time that he publicly grabbed an imam, you know, a Muslim religious leader, and shaved his beard, which is a hugely shameful thing to do, because the imam didn't greet him in the street.
Oh, goodness.
He's
basically a dick. He's basically a dick.
Basically a dick. Yeah. But he was also was a violent dick too. So his job was to enforce the law, and one of the ways he did this took it on personally. One time he single-handedly went and found the chieftain of a tribe of bandits. He fought him, killed him, cut his head off, and displayed it on his desk as a warning to everybody. He ordered that no Indians were allowed to ride next to white men. If an Indian on horseback passed a white man, he was supposed to dismount and bow. And most famously, during the Indian Mutiny, he was very important in putting down the Indian Mutiny in 1857. One famous incident is when he ordered the and oversaw the immediate summary execution of all the cooks, Indian cooks of a regiment, after they discovered that one of them had poisoned the soup of the officers as part one of the mutineers. He also exposed Indian soldiers who might have disguised themselves as civilians during the mutiny by simply having all civilians under his authority, all civilians he would come across, he'd round them up with his soldiers, have the civilians paraded in front of him, and he would just decide whether or not they were soldiers in disguise and kill them. Based on no evidence whatsoever. And even at the time, he was criticized, including by his friends, as I mentioned, for his harsh treatment. But he was also very successful in keeping the British Empire going. So he was a hero, and there are statues to him. There was a statue to him in Delhi, unsurprisingly, after India became independent. They sent it back to his home country of Ireland. The same statue was unveiled by Lord Mountbatten, the uncle of the Duke of Edinburgh, in 1960. The statue that the Indians sent back from Delhi was unveiled in Ireland by Lord Mountbatten, who was the last Viceroy of India. And there's an obelisk to him outside Islamabad, which is put up in 1890 or by 1890. But the point is that this cult was born out of fear and respect of him in the 1840s. But he was a staunch Christian, and he was disgusted by idolatry and by all foreign religions. and the worship of false gods, as he saw it. So he actually tried to stamp out the cult. He tried to eradicate it during his lifetime, but that just made the cultists respect him even more, and he became kind of this godlike figure to them. And eventually he became more of a saint, because they were a Muslim cult, so they don't, obviously there's only one Allah, but he became more of a saint, and then eventually the cult just died out, as I said, in 2004. So yeah.
2004, yeah.
There's, I mean, I know he's sounds like a horrible person, but there's something quite funny about him really hating that everyone's worshipping him. And he's like, I keep killing you and beating you and being incredibly racist. And then, like, we love you. And he's like, stop it. Just stop it.
Yeah. It's true.
But it's funny because I hadn't thought about it.
Wow.
Sorry, Martin.
So it'd be funny if it wasn't so awful.
Yeah, exactly. But it kind of goes back to what you were saying about your example, Martin, which is it's a way perhaps of coping with colonialism, of as the colonized, kind of dealing with these oppressors, essentially. You know, I'm not saying Duke of Edinburgh was an oppressor, not in a direct sense, obviously. He was the conquerors, the rulers. Yeah, just kind of, I wonder if that's where it came from, just dealing with the shock of this horrible, horrible man. So just marching in and imposing British rule in his very tyrannical way.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, I feel like I've read and seen a dozen or so sci-fi and fiction fantasy stories with this kind of thing going on, where people go mad and there's a cult that worships the villain or something, you know. But it's true, there are historical examples for it.
So the cult was still around till 2004. What were their beliefs that he was going to come back at some point?
No, they just believed he had kind of holy powers. Like there's one tradition around him that they had a tradition that one time he beheaded a man and then stuck the head back on and brought him back to life. Which, you know, the first part of that sounds plausible. The second part, maybe not so much.
Yeah.
I don't doubt that.
And stuff like that. And his grave is still there in Delhi. And it looks like it's still fairly well preserved, but it's fairly, no one really goes to worship it. But I do think the cultists used to gather there and kind of, there were stories about his spirit would wander the graveyard, but not in a kind of spooky hoo sense, in a kind of, there's the noble deity.
I see.
Nicol Sayn, you know.
It's not quite turning water into wine, is it?
The same, beheading the same ring to him.
It's like Jesus goes to the wedding at Cana, kicks over all the wine jars, and he's like, take that. Oh, bring it back again. There you go. Water's into wine. It's not quite the same.
It's like you've done nothing.
Jesus
really
kills Lazarus and then brings him back from the dead.
That's an example. Wow.
So there you go.
That's, I mean, crazy, crazy that it lasted for so long. Though.
Yes.
Yeah, really determined cult.
I mean, all of these still going, like, to a certain extent. Or, like, we're going for.
Yeah, it'd be interesting ages to see where the Duke of Edinburgh one goes, how long that lasts, and whether it transforms
anyway. Yes, I mean, as I say, I think there's a few options. It's dropped from several thousand people at its peak to just a few hundred, but it will be interesting to see if they kind of attach this title to anyone else in the royal family, or if it's just reserved for Prince Philip, because it seems like he was the one who left the island and became this powerful figure representing the island of Tanna in the British Empire. So we'll see. We shall see. But I imagine that perhaps it will fizzle out a little bit more with this, especially if they don't see any dramatic change in the kind of the spiritual sense of him returning to the island. Ceremonial and symbolic, maybe, as opposed to anything else.
But maybe there should be a case study, though, because this could be proof of, you know, I think an opportunity for science to study and to like, are gods real? Like, yes, everything they predicted did happen after Prince Thriller died and returned.
Yeah, yeah. Perfect opportunity, yeah. Robin, perfect.
Maybe Prince Andrew will go over there as a new ambassador.
Well, if Prince Philip comes back in a few days' time, yeah. We'll know for sure.
On that lovely note, shall we have a quiz?
Let's.
So, welcome to today's quiz. As always, we'll have 10 questions with a bonus question in case of a tie, and no pressure today, lads, because Martin, this is your chance to get level pegging with all of us. Alex, this is your chance to take the lead.
So, I don't think I've ever been in the lead the entirety of this podcast's existence.
No, you have.
Yes, you have. You've won a series.
I don't think I have, you know. I don't know.
No, you're at the lead at the beginning of season 3, definitely. Definitely.
If I have been, then it's been for like one episode tops.
Well, maybe it will be a second. We'll find out. But first, in order to answer the questions, you need buzzers. Gentlemen, play me your buzzers, Martin.
I've gone for one that's very close to my heart.
Aha! That was not what I was expecting.
Alan Partridge.
I was so expecting Delia.
I thought that was Delia too.
Yeah.
Alex, what's yours?
Well, I have gone for one that's very close to my heart.
The French champagne.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it feels like it's been a while.
Excellence.
Yeah. Can I distinguish clearly between the ahs at the beginning? We'll find out.
We shall see.
We'll see. Yeah. Okay. Well, fingers on buzzer, gentlemen, because question number one is coming your way, and it is, to make things easy, a closest wins. A nice gentle start to the quiz.
Okay.
So, closest wins. How many McDonald's restaurants are there worldwide?
Worldwide. Oh my god.
Oh my goodness.
How to
work this out? That's what I'm trying to think.
How far do you go? How low do you go? You worldwide. Just don't know.
Okay. I'm gonna do the honourable thing and go first, Alex. Yeah, that's
very noble of you, Martin.
I'm really, really glad that you decided that.
There are how many per person? That's the question. 112,000.
Okay.
Oh, that's a damn good guess. Is that a lot? I was thinking not too far away.
The French champagne.
Mm-hmm. I'll go for a nice even 100,000.
Alex is closest. There are only 39,198 McDonald's restaurants worldwide.
Oh, well, I don't
think only 39,000.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. There's about 1,500 in the UK. Which is not as many as I thought there would be.
I thought there'd be a few more. I didn't think there'd be tons more than that. But I was just thinking with the landmass that we have, I was thinking that other countries would have more.
Actually, that's a good point. Yeah. Our density is high enough that we don't need so many. Yeah, but there just must be some countries they haven't quite launched into yet.
I know that
still 39,000.
This is still quite a lot. Yeah, and growing presumably.
Yes.
Subway is the most popular, isn't it? They've got the most branches.
Subway's got loads,
Like, I think they're just all the franchises, way denser.
Square mile of London, you'll have 10 subways.
Yeah.
Also, McDonald's tend to be pretty massive, don't they? Whereas a Subway can be fit into basically a closet.
That's true. Subway may have more, but the seating area is like 2 to 4 people can sit in any single Subway in the city.
Yeah.
Whereas, McDonald's always bigger. Okay, on to question two, and it's 1-0 to Alex.
Okay.
Who is the only person in the UK who can drive without a license?
Can say Prince Philip.
Alex, I heard you. Buzz.
Is it Queen Elizabeth II?
It is.
It is indeed. Or perhaps we should just say the monarch, given the way things are looking. Who knows? By the time this quiz goes out. The Queen Elizabeth II is the only person in the UK who can drive without a license, because licenses are actually issued in her name, so I think it's a technicality. She can't issue herself a license. So,
or she can just say, no, it's fine. I've told myself it's fine.
The Queen has approved.
I've checked.
Imagine if she got pulled over for drunk driving. She wouldn't. Never.
Could she like, if she... Not saying this would ever happen, but hypothetically, if she crashed into a car, could she go over to there, say, like, license and registration, I don't approve of this, actually, and then, like, tear it up?
Yeah. That's an interesting question. Is it a crime if she... Yeah.
Could she take other people's licenses and say, no, actually, I specifically don't approve of this?
Let us know in the comments to this. If you're watching us on YouTube or if there are comments available on your podcast platform of choice, please let us know. Do you think the Queen can do that kind of thing? Anything that's issued in her name, can she go up to an individual and take it from them because she's decided that she doesn't want to issue it to them?
If the Queen was way more petty and sassy, could she do this?
And a traffic cop.
And a traffic cop.
Okay, well, 2-0 to Alex, going into question 3.
Oh, dear.
This is definitely a fingers on buzzers because it's a true or false. So 50-50 here. True or false? Fish and insects close their eyes when they sleep.
Aha!
I heard Martin.
That's false. They keep their eyes open.
True. As in, correct. It is false. Well done.
That's really confusing.
Yeah.
So they do keep their eyes open.
They do. They sleep with their eyes open. In the case of insects, I don't even know if they have lids over with which they can close their eyes. Yeah. But fish do blink, but they sleep with their eyes open. So that's 2-1 to Alex, going into question 4. How many bones does a giraffe have in its neck?
In its neck.
And this is not a closest wins. I need an answer.
I don't know that.
Make an educated guess.
Never seen a giraffe skeleton.
Aha!
Have I? No.
Martin, I think you buzzed in. Yeah.
Yes. It just has the one.
One bone in its neck.
Just one long bone.
One long bone. Okay.
I have no idea.
I'm going to say you're wrong.
Okay, cool. Alex, you have a go and then I'll revise my answer.
I don't mean to laugh. I'm just imagining like one bone, and it can't like bend its neck.
They move their necks like crazy, don't they?
They are quite, especially
when they fight.
If it's a specific answer, how would we guess it? If it was like 112, we're not going to.
It's not going to be masses, is it?
No.
The French champagne has always been celebrated for its excellence.
Yes, Alex.
They have 6.
No, they don't. Okay, give you both one more guess.
Okay.
To revise your answers. But I will say that you're both in the right area.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they actually have 8 bones in the neck.
Okay. Alex, what's your second revised answer?
I would say that then, in that case, that they have 5 bones in the neck.
The correct answer is 7. You both managed to dance around it. They have 7 bones in their neck, which, to be honest, is a lot fewer than I expected.
Way fewer, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how does it work then? Do they just have lots of muscle instead, or?
I think they're fairly large vertebrae as well as having lots of muscle. So I think the largest one is about 10 inches. I want to say vertebrae. It's about 10 inches big. I think I may have got. Yeah. Maybe 10 centimetres. There's a big difference between 10 centimetres and 10 inches. I should have written it down. But that leads me on to question number 5, and it's still 2-1 to Alex. How many bones does a human have
neck? Wait a second.
Oh.
Wait a second, Robin. I missed out on saying that's what she said. Carry on.
Okay. I was. I'm glad you did that. I almost made the joke, but I thought that's a bit cruel to my wife.
A bit crude, yeah. So I thought I'd take up the mantle.
Thank you. So question number 5 is, how many bones does a human have in its neck?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Oh, yep. That's a buzz in from Alex.
There's the vertebrae, isn't there?
We have 12.
That's incorrect. Martin, do you have a guess?
12. one, where you've got the main spinal. I imagine that we're talking about the neck. We're not talking about like the spinal.
We're not talking about the back, spine, the back, the vertebrae in the spine, the back. No, well, but we are.
I think we've got less than that.
Okay.
I'm actually going to go for one, two,
it's actually counting.
Maybe
I love this.
Three, four. We've got four.
No, I'll give you both one more guess. You can revise your answer. Alex went for 12 and Martin went for 4, and you're both wrong.
I'm just trying to think. Don't we know the bones of the neck that well?
The French champagne.
Yes, Alex?
How many was giraffe? 8, did you say?
7.
7.
7, mm-hmm. Did you say?
Yeah.
I'm going to go 7. I think we're the same.
I was thinking of doing that too.
So what is your revised answer, Martin?
I can't go for the same, can I?
Can do if you want.
No, that's not how this works.
Hey, it is on the Quizmaster. I'm saying you can both revise your answer and go for the same thing if you like.
What?
I won't. You've said it first, so I won't. I'll go for 9.
The correct answer is 7. Yes, giraffes and humans have the same number of vertebrae in their neck.
I should have stuck with it. Yeah. Why not? Alex just convinced me. I can't do that.
No, so it wasn't. It wasn't a closest wins or anything. It was a. It was just. It was guessing.
And to Alex. Okay. You know, in closest wins, we're entitled to guess
look,
the same number.
I don't want to win in a bad way.
Okay, so question number 6. Still plenty of time for Martin to catch up here, because it's only 3-1.
Okay.
Question number 6. What is the largest landlocked country in the world? Largest.
The largest landlocked country in the world.
In the world.
That's a good question.
Is it going... Oh, actually, oh, crap. Could it be...
Aha!
Yes.
Democratic Republic, People's Republic of Congo.
It is not. It is not. Don't they have a coast? They have a coast, don't they?
Do they?
Don't they? Maybe I'm wrong. I could be wrong. Ignore me. I could be wrong about that. But it's not Congo, no. That would be nice. That would have tied in nicely with
previous. I know, that's what I was thinking. That's what I thought of it.
So, Alex, you have a guess?
Champagne.
Not to the flight attack.
Different area. Kazakhstan?
Yes.
Is it actually?
It is Kazakhstan, yeah. No? Question number 7, and it is 4-1, I think, to Alex.
Oof.
There's still time. Yeah. There's still time for Martin to do this. Martin is the comeback king, as he has proved on many occasions. He likes to come from behind.
Not counting my chickens yet. Is that the saying? Counting my eggs? Chickens.
Yeah. Count your chickens before they're hatched. Yeah.
Chickens.
Yes.
Yeah. Not about eggs.
Not count my eggs before they're laid. Yeah.
I thought I was just going insane. Saying words.
I will never count eggs. That's the phrase, right?
Don't count your yolks before you've cracked your eggs. Is that what you're going for? Yeah.
You gotta.
Anyway, question number 7. Which counting eggs. Is Shakespeare's longest play?
Ooh. You're not making this easy, Robin. You're not making this easy.
No. Longest play.
I mean, for those of you watching or listening
at home,
really
guessing it,
is the wee small hours of the morning. So actually, this is quite unfair to ask these two these kind of questions.
Aha!
Martin, I heard Martin.
Let's go for A Tale of... I don't want to do that one. Macbeth, why not?
It is not Macbeth.
Sorry.
Yep, Alex.
Another one of the big ones. Let's go for To Be or Not to Be, Hamlet.
It is Hamlet.
Ah!
It is actually
well
Hamlet. Hamlet is over 30,000 words long. The shortest one is A Comedy of Errors, which is fewer than 15,000 words.
There we go.
The reason I said Hamlet is I once saw a production of Hamlet starring Michael Sheen.
Oh, really?
There we go.
And it was long. It was very long.
I don't think any full production of Hamlet doesn't last fewer than 4 hours normally.
Yeah, really yeah. was extensive.
I went and saw The Tempest.
Oh yeah,
at the Globe.
That's a good one.
At the Globe, that was long.
Yeah,
that was pretty long. And it was like a boiling July day, and the heat coming down. You have to stand up.
Oh, you were standing.
And, yeah, there are people like close to passing out.
Yeah.
It was crazy. It wasn't actually. It was an experience, but it wasn't necessarily that enjoyable.
Yeah, I would not want to stand for a Shakespeare play. Gosh, Martin, well done for enduring that.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you.
So, question number 8, and this is
5-1. 5-1 4. We're just playing for a bit of pride here, aren't I?
Yeah, you can make this 5-4, and then it looks like it was a close run thing, which it would have been.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem like that right now.
Kind of feel bad. I was very angry about the point situation earlier. Now, do you want the? You were going to say 7. Do you want the extra point? Make it more interesting.
No, it's all good. It's all good.
Well, what type of animal is a waxy monkey?
A waxy monkey.
A waxy monkey. Yes,
a waxy monkey.
Waxy as in a candle. Yeah, waxy. Yeah.
Oh.
Is it a fish?
No. Although Martin buzzed, so you didn't get the right to answer that.
I didn't buzz.
I heard aha. Oh no, it was the French. Sorry. Sorry, that was Alex's.
I mean, if it's not a fish, then it's a bird.
No.
Oh.
There's only two types of animal in the world, Robert.
Fishes and birds.
It's fish, no.
I'm afraid no. This is probably a bit more specific than bird or fish.
Okay,
but it's not too specific. But it's
a waxy monkey.
Yeah,
waxy
monkey. Sounds maybe amphibian. What about a frog? Up a frog?
It is. It's a tree frog. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Good guess, yeah.
Quite cool-looking frogs. They're green with colourful stripes, yeah.
Oh, nice.
A waxy monkey is a frog. Well done. So, 5-2, going on to question 9. I'm afraid it's another country-based question. On average,
love country-based questions.
Which country eats the most cheese per person? On average.
Most cheese.
Yeah.
Champagne.
French.
Yes. Alex.
I mean, that was the obvious guess. I won't go for France, though. How about Switzerland?
No, but I see what you're thinking. Small country, but at the heart of Europe, with lots of cheese being made around it. Yep.
No.
Aha! Yes, Martin.
I think it's definitely going to be European, isn't it? Probably. Most likely. I'm going to go for Germany.
Germany is the second most cheese-eating country in the world. So close.
No, they didn't have many vegetables when I went there.
No.
I'm sure they do.
Yes, Alex.
Sticking to the same area,
uh-huh.
I'm going to say the Netherlands.
Ah, it's between those two.
No, it's not the Netherlands.
Oh, no.
No.
I was thinking Netherlands. I was eyeing out between the Netherlands and Germany.
So, shall I give it to you?
Go for it. Yeah, go for it.
You're both very close. You've both listed countries that border
so like Belgium,
the Czech Republic.
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, of course.
Yeah, okay. And they got exposed as a very heavy drinking country. So Germany is the second most cheese-consuming country in the world, with 37 kilograms of cheese consumed per year per person on average. 37 kilograms. The Czech Republic consumes, on average, 64 kilograms of cheese per person.
What?
That's almost double the second place.
Yeah, that's my body weight in cheese.
64 kilos. How much is that per day? 200 grams per day.
That's a lot of cheese. Although I've been there, and admittedly, there's like cheese. The cheese is served with a lot of their meals, and there's not a lot of vegetables. In fact, there are no vegetables. You have to go out of your way to find a place that serves greens as a side dish.
Sounds like my kind of place. Where do I sign up?
It's great food, not going to lie. Great food, but stodgy is the word of the day. Okay, question number 10. I've lost track of the score now. It was 5-2? 5-2, I think.
5-3, I think, now, maybe.
I didn't get that one right, though. 5-2, I think, still.
Yeah, sadly. Question number 10. This is this can be a closest win. So why not? Historically speaking, back in the 1880s when they first emerged, how many stories did a building have to be considered a skyscraper?
Skyscraper.
Aha! Yes, Alan.
Round number 10.
Yes.
Yay!
10.
I win the quiz.
Had 10, at least 10 stories. It was a skyscraper.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
10 points, 1 point for each floor.
Well done. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I'll tell you what, I was a bit scared we were going to get to question 10 and it would be like, now this question's worth 10 points.
Yeah, I've done that before, but no, not this time. That would have been a nice one. So yeah, so final score 5-3 to Alex.
Oh, well, that's not too bad.
That's all right. That's good. That's decent. Yeah.
Congratulations, yeah. Alex. It was a
thank
solid
you.
Victory.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Congratulations to Robin for the successful quiz.
Only successful because you won it. That's, it would be a different story if Martin
absolutely.
Had won.
Fantastic quiz.
But yeah, I mean, that puts you in the lead, Alex. So you're on pole position to seize that trophy.
I'm
grasp
taking that trophy
awesome
that
from Martin's good. Hands. Eventually, if anyone who watches on
cold,
YouTube might see the trophy at some point on the podcast.
I reckon you've lost it, Martin. I think you've lost it and you've been trying to cover it this whole time.
You traded it for some quavers.
Yeah. I'm 80% sure it's in my cupboard.
80%. Closest wins. How sure is Martin? Would you like the bonus question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Go for
this
it.
Is actually, the answer to this is a percentage, coincidentally. Closest wins. What percentage of the human body weight does the brain take up?
Human body
weight? What percentage of the human body weight is the brain? Aha! Yes, Martin.
It's exactly 6%.
Okay, that's your guess.
It sounds a bit high, actually.
The brain take up.
Head's quite heavy, though. So.
Yeah, head is heavy. Mm.
Yes, Alex.
4%.
Ooh, Alex is closer. It is 2.3%.
There we go.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I was thinking, like, is this going to be a trick? Is it going to be like 20%?
There's lots of heavy bones in the body, I guess, isn't there?
Yeah.
I think, interestingly, if I remember correctly, it was the average of in a woman, the brain on average occupies 2.31% of their body weight. In men, it's 2.28%. So it's actually, so it averages out quite nicely at 2.3%. Okay. That's probably because of increased muscle mass on the atypical male.
That's what we tell ourselves.
Well, thank you for that, gentlemen. Thank you for that quiz. And thank you for that really interesting podcast. I enjoyed it. I learned a lot about deities, particularly on that island. I'm going to go there on holiday. Once we're allowed to travel, become a god.
Go on holiday and finally be loved by everyone.
Worship me!
What are you all watching and listening to us? Please give us a tweet at JInterestingYT or comment below on the YouTube video if you're watching us on YouTube with your thoughts and with any stories of other deities that you're aware of, as in people worshipped as deities. Or do you worship someone as a god? Let us know who it is and why.
And why is it Nicolas Cage?
Why is it Nicolas Cage? And we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.